You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, we're looking at how experimental cinema and experimental approaches to cinema recycle and reuse intriguing images from the past. Later in the podcast, I'm talking to Wajid Yassin, the artistic director of Ear Cinema, about their touring project Late Noon Sun, which uses silent movie tropes and iconography in a haunting theatrical installation about murder and magic. Before that, I've reunited the presenters of Resonance FM's long-missed radio show, Midnight Sex Talk, for a preview of the short films of experimental filmmaker Jeff Keane, which are about to be shown at the BFI South Bank and elsewhere, and released in a new definitive box set. Midnight Sex Talk used to be on Resonance FM at 11:30 p.m. on alternate Sunday nights, and there's an archive online of their shows at www.midnightsextalk.com. MST co-presenter Kim Morgan will be joining us later, and for the rest of the time I'm talking to presenter Tanya Glide, who also worked as the agony aunt for Time Out magazine and has recently written the book Cleaning Up, How I Gave Up Drinking and Lived, which has just been published in paperback. Jeff Keane's films mix found footage of pop culture items and iconography, combined with experimental scenes of domesticity, landscapes, and violence. There are four compilations of Jeff's work being shown at the BFI South Bank over the next 2 weeks, and in March at various cinemas in Bristol, Hastings, and Belfast, more info about which you can find at www.bfi.org.uk. And also in March, a definitive 4DVD box set is being released on their label. For this podcast review of his work, I sat down with Tanya, and we watched 7 of Keane's films in a row, with Kim joining us for the 8th, and we stopped after each one to record our immediate thoughts on what we'd just seen. Marvo Movie, 16mm, 1967.
Anyway, here we are, and we've just watched the first one, which is Marvo Movie, 1967.
I do like the Ken Russell quote, actually.
Yes.
It went right over my head and seemed a little threatening, but I'm all for it.
Well, it did seem a little threatening. All these sibilant, hissing voices, and also the accents that they have, you felt it was the 60s.
Yeah.
People would use very different voices now, I think, to get the same impression. So it was very hissy and slightly posh feel. But that wasn't bad. I thought that worked with it.
Well, you couldn't actually hear what they were saying. I think
most
the only
of the time,
sentence I could work out was appropriately what's going on.
Oh, right. No, that...
But I've never been very good at, if I'm in a loud room or whatever, making out even the person I'm talking to. So.
Well, maybe that's what he's trying to say there as well. Yeah. Just too many voices. Now, he's obviously... Are we supposed to think he's commenting on war in all of this? A bit of an anti-American feel with all this horrible Mickey Mouse-ness and Mickey Mouse makeup.
I mean, it was as much, you know, an assault on the senses visually as it was an audio cacophony.
It was. You could see that at a gig. I could imagine that without, minus the sound, as a backdrop to all sorts of different kinds of music. And it would have been quite mesmerising to watch.
At the risk of asking the question that you don't ask a lady, when did you start going to gigs when they started showing visuals like that? Presumably they would have done that in the
60s.
They
would have.
60mm projector.
That's absolutely true, they would. I mean, I was just thinking, when this was made, I was one.
Right.
I wasn't going to
I wasn't suggesting you were that old, Tanya.
No, I'm talking about the 90s, really. I mean, obviously there were visuals. I went to gigs before that, but I can't remember, to be honest. I can't remember visuals.
But it seems very 60s, though. I know what you mean, because I've not watched many of the films of Kenneth Anger, but they have the same kind of strange juxtapositions that are vaguely threatening and, you know, mixed
toys
nature
and,
with found footage and toys. And
yeah, it was actually quite hard to listen to and watch, I thought.
And it's interesting, we're watching this at the beginning of 2009 when there's a dreadful film based on The Spirit in the cinemas, and there was a Spirit comic on screen briefly alongside The Flash and Mickey Mouse and other pop culture icons in there. So again, it's just everything old is new again.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. Maybe we'll see context. When we've watched more of them, we'll see context of it as well, I think.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Like the Time Is Now, 8mm, 1961.
Well, I look at the date, 61. So that was quite early for all of that. And of course, there was the jazz.
Yes.
Blue Notes and Blue Stockings. So I almost wonder whether it's good to be influenced by the descriptions on the paper, actually. But I suppose the beatnik life was very forward for Britain in 1961. I know obviously people were doing it before. So he was drinking out the demijohns of probably disgusting wine or cider. Mm. Cider, probably.
But at the same time, like I said, the last one, Everything Old is New Again, I can imagine that being
that scene. Oh, yeah.
a new cross squat right now. People drinking cheap cider and reading comics and wearing funny hats and playing games with each other.
And I don't know whether we were supposed to think they were smoking spliff as well, or just cigarettes. We're not sure. We see the overflowing ashtray. Were they students? Were they a bit old for students? I think they were probably students.
Well, in the biographical notes that they gave us with the DVD, there was a lot of mention of how he was interested in home movies. And certainly that had a home movie style to it, even if it was designed as a work of fiction, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it was quite violent at the beginning. If a chicken was a chicken thrown,
something was thrown at someone's head.
And then
you saw a chicken.
I saw. You see, that's the point. He wanted us. I felt there was a therapy feel to it all. I don't know why. But let's act out some rages now. Let's put boxing gloves on and punch each other. But again, there would have been a lot of talk about that in the early 60s and also in those kind of circles, I'm sure.
Well, I'm curious about the order that they've got the shorts on this compilation DVD, that they're not in chronological order. So
they're not.
To see
I noticed
an early
that.
One after a later one. And this early one, it does have almost subliminal images on screen, but not in so provocative a way as the one that he would make 6 years later.
He's
still using them as a tool, you know, to quickly get ideas to the audience without overwhelming them, which I thought was quite interesting. And I'm surprised, actually, that the short wasn't called Let's Go to the Movies, because I think that appears on screen three times in a speech bubble.
Yeah, yeah. The first bit where it feels like they're fighting, the camera angle was of the floor, almost like it was attached to one of them, wasn't it, while they were moving about. I thought that was quite interesting.
Mm.
But it was quite a violent... There was a feeling of being hunted about it.
Mm.
Now, maybe that was partly the big contrastiness of it, the black and white. There was a sort of menacingness to it, and yet you think, well, if they're going to get stoned and drunk, they're probably all going to get paranoid.
I think I found it more playful than you did.
Oh,
I didn't feel it that menacing.
Oh, right. No, and then they were mucking about a bit more. I sensed very strongly the bit where the camera went on the three of them. She sort of passed out on the bed. Mm. One guy's sitting up and the other one's leaning against the bed. And there was that, we're quite wasted, what will we do now turning point? Are they all going to have sex with each other, for example?
Mm. I mean, the most menacing thing for me was the guy with the fake eyes and the fake teeth smoking underneath a hat that emerges from darkness.
Yes, the horrible sort of skull face.
Yeah.
Yes, you felt he...
That was some sort of satanic presence.
It was a bit satanic, which is what obviously he did a lot more of in Marvo movies 6 years later, making masks come from... And obviously that really was the guy wearing a mask.
Mm.
It wasn't superimposed from something else. Maybe he's into menace.
Mm. Thinking back actually to that sort of the Mickey Mouse face in Marvo movie, it almost predicts, and I wonder how much William Friedkin, for example, watched experimental movies, that shot in The Exorcist where they briefly have the
horrible face, which someone then used for an album cover, didn't they?
Did they?
In the 90s. Yes, you've got a point. This whole cutting, I don't know what you call it, rapid superimposing stuff, but it would have influenced him. I'm sure for that.
Plasmatic Blast. Video, 1990s.
Okay. I think that went on a bit long at nine minutes.
Nine minutes of a plasmatic blast. Spelled B-L-A-T-Z.
Yeah, I mean it...
It was just like the first one. It was like Marvo movie all over again. But
updated technology.
Yeah.
It looked more like graffiti, some of the layers of different things there. And I don't think that necessarily did it for it. I thought there were bits that looked quite beautiful. I thought, well, why didn't you keep that style for a while?
Mm.
But
it's just the attention span thing. You know, he just can't focus on a single image for more than
3 seconds.
Which
makes him very modern.
Yes.
Because I remember...
Well, Stan Brakhage was doing that back in the 60s as well.
Oh,
but I suppose these things come in cycles. It feels very modern because people weren't doing that for years.
Yeah, and I suppose I was thinking... You remember when someone coined the phrase three-minute culture, which I think was in the late 80s-ish.
Mm.
And at the time, people were going, 3 minutes, and no one can handle a sound bite of any more than 3 minutes. Now it's 3 seconds.
Yes.
I mean, it's positively slow back then, so maybe his attention span sort of looks ahead.
Wrong. Well, there were reoccurring images. There were dolls being set on fire by a blowtorch, and which was one of the nice juxtapositions, actually. He was using a blowtorch in one scene, and they juxtaposed that with the sound of a jet as an image of a jet went past. That was one of the few things I latched onto. I thought I quite liked that. But like you said, it didn't last more than 3 seconds.
No, it didn't. And I mean, I quite like using that dam bursting or whatever that sea picture was, because it could have been
lava. Flood destroying the land.
It could have been fiery.
I mean, it had an apocalyptic thing going on.
It did have an apocalyptic... Yeah, it did. You see, I sometimes wonder, what is the purpose of this? Who is this going to be shown to and when?
Yeah.
But I think you're not supposed to ask that kind of question, are you, about these things?
Well, it'll be interesting when we get to the last one on this disc, Art War, which was commissioned by Channel 4.
Okay.
The rest of these are presumably just our personal projects that he did to amuse himself and his friends. I don't know. I mean, I'll have to have another look through the biography, just who his audience was. I mean, there were times when he seemed to be working in art collectives and so was doing things for the group, but, you know, after 40 years...
Well, yeah, I mean, it says here he's using found footage, but, I mean, he really did do his best to drown the found footage
in
layers of colour. It looked very early 90s ravey in some ways. You can see he was probably influenced by that, and maybe this would be playing in some club somewhere without the noise, without the soundtrack over it.
Ray Day film, 16mm, 1969.
13 minutes.
13 minutes. I was about to ask you how long it had to go, actually. So, actually, that meant I was more absorbed in it than I realised.
I guess so.
And
it didn't seem actually as long as the 9-minute one.
No, it really didn't at all. And I thought there were some quite funny bits, and I thought it was interesting where there was suddenly that bit saying, back to 1942. That very specific war bit. Yeah, so I suddenly thought, so he's really specifically gone back to his own life there, because he was in the war and everything, wasn't he? And, and suddenly you had the sky and there was some lightning and bombers or something like that. There was... But yeah, it looked like they were having a good time. It really does flash past very fast, actually. You almost want to watch it in slow motion.
That was my first thought. Until he started playing again with the double exposures and things, that sort of turns it into the incomprehensibility that you got from some of his earlier films. I thought, actually, I'm enjoying this, and I'd enjoy it even more if it was at half speed.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. I mean, it would have been twice as long then.
Yes.
But okay, we could have, we could
maybe
have gone
two-thirds
there.
Speed.
Yeah, I know. I
have to find the optimum frame rate for watching his film.
Yes, you're right. There probably has to be one. Actually, you could do that with a lot of filmmakers. Mm. They all want to discuss.
You can see themes cropping up. I mean, we've watched four of his films now.
We've had the melting dolls and the fires.
Yeah, melting plastic. He likes starting fires on electric hobs. Or,
oh, yes, yes. Melting that, throwing that parachute thing. That must be a war hangover, throwing a parachute with a stone.
And all the comic book thing I'm enjoying, actually.
Yeah, there was some comic book lettering, yeah.
Because, you know, the film criticism of comic books, or comic books in general, we still haven't escaped from articles starting, pow, bam, the comic comes of age. But, you know, that all comes back to the 1960s Batman TV series, but no one else has ever really done that in film. And I quite like the fact that this guy is putting visual word effects on screen, you know, like sound effects and speech bubbles.
What content? I mean, this was made in 69, the one we just... Obviously, the Batman stuff was before that.
The other antique aspect of this is in the description of Ray Day film, they're talking about Dadaism. And certainly one of the art movements that was linked to Dada was Metz painting, where people made sort of 3D reliefs of just collecting rubbish and sticking it down. And that's something that he kind of does on film.
Yeah, you're right, actually. There was the sort of busted doll's leg being melted at the full mannequin's leg at the beginning.
But it did start off like a lost scene from a Richard Lester film or an episode of The Goodies, and that's why I enjoyed it the most. It had a kind of innocence.
Speeding around.
Before it suddenly started becoming dark again.
yes, it did. And then we had a bit more sexual imagery and woman's body and all of that.
Well, it's the Summer of Love, 1969.
Yes, of course. Yeah, there had to be some of that. It had to be a bit of nudity. But not heavy on the nudity.
No.
But there just had to be some, you could tell. And there's a strong feeling of Terry Gilliam with some of the animations as well. But then when was Gilliam doing
around
his
first?
Around the same time.
Yeah.
That some of those slightly old-fashioned images, what am I trying to say, older Victorian-type pictures being made to animate, that kind of thing. I mean, it looked like he was having a lot of fun with this while at the same time acting out some quite dark themes.
Well, but I've enjoyed this one the most out of the four so far.
But I think the World War and the impression it left on people growing up in it.
A generation of post-traumatic stress.
Traumatised. I mean, if you're watching family being the street being bombed or having to beg and steal to survive or whatever. Different world. Completely different world. And like I said, he must have been enjoying being the older filmmaker because he was in his late 30s when he made that one. So he would have quite enjoyed being the film daddy to all these young, just discovering drugs, just discovering sex or whatever, young people in the 60s. It must have been quite interesting because obviously he had that seriousness at the back, having seen all the war, but probably maybe envying them not having known that. Coming at the tail end of rationing or whatever as tiny children.
Well, it's nice to see someone embrace that because, you know, you read, you hear all these sort of reports of the time of angry older, you know, gentleman who fought in the war going, this is, you know, we protected your country from the Nazis and you're all taking drugs and listening to loud music. This isn't what we saved you
but
for.
That, the trouble but is that's precisely, exactly, what, that's precisely what you saved people for. So they could go and lie around and wear beads, you know, and things like that. That's precisely what it was. And I'm not surprised that people got, people probably felt shortchanged.
Yeah.
Not really knowing what better society they were looking for, just to make sure they hadn't got this, this monster running the country or running Europe. And then suddenly, what are people doing? They're not sitting around really quietly, sort of being all respectful and good. They're having a sexual revolution, and I'm not surprised. But this guy obviously wasn't that kind of person, despite having fought in the war, and was obviously an artist, you know. Although, as we know, he went on and became the park's gardener in the, in the town, sort of, so by the sea. I think, another thing I would say, I think Brighton probably would have influenced his work. All the pier and all that kind of thing, the flashing colours and all the kind of seasideness of it. I think that's inevitably going to influence him.
And now from the Summer of Love, we're going to 1984.
Fantastic.
The Dreams and Past Crimes of the Archduke. 16mm, 1984.
It had that dot effect on the screen that when you're sort of a bit close up. Where was that one?
Well, we don't know what we just watched because...
No, you said video, so...
Well, no, at first I thought video, but actually but I think it was very grainy 8mm. I think what he did, what it looked like, was he had very old nitrate footage, presumably a copy of nitrate footage, projected on a wall and then zoomed into it to really accentuate, because I've done this myself.
Okay.
And then to accentuate the grain, and then did another one of his increasingly ubiquitous double exposures, where it seemed to be all about relics of cinema, that it was old footage, including, it looked like Victorian pornography.
Yes, yeah.
Superimposed someone walking through the wreckage of a cinema.
Yes, I would have to watch it again because I was so busy looking for this other stuff that that I was almost ignoring what was in the film. And just primary colours on it as well, sort of green and red, and then this passionate classical music as opposed to some sort of hissed repetitive thing in the background. So he's obviously having a lyrical moment there. It's actually quite hard to watch after a while, and I actually wouldn't mind knowing what was going on in those scenes. I mean, call me old-fashioned. I had some murder things, and there was a gun and some stuff, but again, I was
still
sort of...
There's still a photo of Brighton Station.
Was that Brighton Station?
Could be.
Probably was. Must have been. That one was starting to lose me, actually, because... Why was he going so... What is this epilepsy-inducing speed thing?
I don't... Well, I'm very glad that we're taking breaks between all the short
films.
Well,
so am I. I was actually
because if you were to watch an hour
sick.
Of this back
I mean,
to back...
I'm very sick. I'd have to shut my eyes. Really, a lot.
Well, I suppose to an extent in A Clockwork Orange, where Alex had been deprogrammed at the end and he's being shown all these images of war and destruction. And then also in the dreadful director's cut of Donnie Darko, there's a shot where Donnie is having the information from the philosophy of time travel, Dan Brooke, into his brain. It's all these flickering images. And it really does feel like you're being deprogrammed watching some of these short films. I mean, I guess...
Scramble people
know,
by
maybe,
flash images at them. I mean, no, science
had
that
Are we reading too
before.
Much into it? I don't know. I mean... It's hard to tell because you see these things from our perspective. But yeah, to make these short films that are so super compressed.
I mean, I understand throwing in some subliminal imagery like the Exorcist thing. You see what ideas to plant. But when the whole thing is these images flashing, I don't know, is it meant to have a quiz later saying, well, how have you spotted the teddy bear? And how many have you spotted the picture of Harold Wilson or something? I don't know.
I mean, I wonder what kind of criteria that these films were shown under, whether... They would be surrounded by very different films. So, you know, you'd have something long
maybe.
And lyrical, and then you'd have 30 seconds of, you know,
that
Jeff Keane madness. And then
maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. Because actually, they must have taken, obviously, quite a long time to make.
Oh, absolutely. The cutting, you know, you know, frame by frame animation, you know.
Yeah, that must have taken days.
The BFI is showing three selections of his short films on the big screen in the South Bank. We'll be sitting for an hour and a half for these things. And I don't know if Jeff himself ever would have wanted people to do that.
I don't think so.
If it becomes an endurance test watching someone's films, you know, then actually you're losing your audience.
He was just an artist in the sense of it's like, I've got this idea, we're going to muck around and we're going to make it. And we're going to just... And obviously he was someone who loved art but always worked and supported himself while he did his art, and obviously it was the 60s and have a bit of a mess around.
White Lie, 16mm, 1968.
You don't see films shot entirely in negative very often, and it works better in black and white than it does in colour when you're going to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that using his interest in comics, he actually used it to influence the visual style of that one, because the props and the mise-en-scène that he chose for that short were presumably things that in positive have quite harsh contrast to them, because in negative it actually made bits of the film look like animation, just because you were having these sharp white lines on screen, almost like one of these, you know, modern Frank Miller films, where you've got the opposite of what you expect, where blood is drawn in white on a black background, and the mortar between bricks is white between black bricks.
Okay.
To give it a very kind of harsh comic book look, which
I thought that aspect of it worked, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
And the soundtrack as well for that one, it wasn't silent, but it was just the sound, I think, of wind against a microphone.
Oh, yes,
I don't know,
yes.
Something like that.
Yeah, kind of a bit more interference level of sound rather than this kind of howling and everything.
I thought, just comparing the soundtrack of this one to the previous one, Crimes of the Archduke, it sounded like the soundtrack was taken directly from trailers from 1960s sort of monster movies.
Yeah, oh yes,
maybe
that's a
even
point.
Japanese.
Yes, there's
ones,
lots of horror movie stuff in there.
But it also sounded like the music from Godzilla, so maybe it was sort of American releases of Japanese horror films or something.
Oh, could have been.
Because I was only catching fragments, as you do, you know, sort of, you know,
the monster's mask,
the aliens are coming, sort of.
Yeah.
And yet, with this one, with White Light, the title of it, or at least on screen, there's something about Antimatter Man and Bride of the Atom, and before we've had character called Volvina and Plastic Man. It's his own personal universe of kind of like bizarre, vaguely eroticized version of superheroes that I guess maybe this is the film equivalent of underground comics in a way.
Yeah.
Of Robert Crumb.
I mean, yeah, I don't know about Antimatter Man. That was probably a character in some cartoon, wasn't it?
Probably.
Yeah.
Or at least evokes, you know.
Yeah.
Blatzom, 16mm, 1986.
Okay, we've now...
12 minutes of Tony Hart on acid.
And a bit of Rolf Harris thrown in as well.
Could you tell what it was yet?
Again, I thought there were some good bits in it. Mm. Guy walking around with a plastic bag with Blatzom written on it or whatever. And I quite like the plastic bag element. He's getting a bit older by then, so he's shuffling around.
And it's nice that there were breaks in it as well. You had
yes,
a black
like
screen
breaks.
For a few seconds
breaks
that you could recover.
So that your epilepsy was not going to quite happen.
I mean, it does feel like we're being a little bit hard on him.
Well, it's watching all of them back to back, which I think is not a good idea at all. What's this symbol which looks like sort of double men's genitalia?
There are obviously all these strange signs and symbols in his work.
In his world,
If you've watched, you know, 30 years of his work, maybe you'll start to see themes and try to interpret it in your own way. But
that keeps coming up, though. It's that and that. And
for the benefit of radio, Tanya just drew it in the air, a back-to-back double male genitalia
stroke. Which is just odd. Maybe it does. Maybe it's an ancient sign from Thailand, or maybe it was posted somewhere abroad.
But speaking of ancient signs, though, I mean, bits of that one were shot by the White Horse of...
Yes.
Near Avebury.
Yeah, so we saw one of the Avebury stones in the background. So he brought in a little very obvious ancient spiritual symbols in there. Mm.
And at the same time, not only was that a film made by an artist, it was a film of an artist at work, because you actually saw him painting at times, which is quite nice, you know, to remind you that he had an artistic practice rather than just,
The kind of
curator
acting
of found footage.
Yeah. There's lots of irony in his work, but he hasn't gone war is evil. But maybe actually by the time...
Fruitless destruction?
Well, yeah, fruitless destruction, but I think maybe by the time he was making films, his war experience was 20 to 30 years before. He'd already matured, thought about life and wars. He wasn't going to be such an overt pro-anti person. He was going to be looking at it from other angles, I think. He's acting it out again and again. As they say, it can be a sexual experience going into battle. People get so worked up. I don't know, maybe you don't know.
Well, certainly you've had pink, fleshy guns in a couple
of
these.
And we've had sort of violent sausage-shaped things running around and things like that. And lots of insertions by cutouts and things like that. Mm.
But also he was going down that Doctor Who road. In the notes, they're describing the black and white footage as looking like a dusty, grey, moon-like landscape.
But
I guess everything looks strange in his films after a while, even when you're juxtaposing a variety of shots of the normal together. Just like the barrage of images becomes surrealist because you can't take it all in. You know, I remember...
Good point. He's just battering you with a whole pile of really quite ordinary things. Mm. Apart from his squiggly drawings and his sort of cut-out weapons.
Art War, video, 1993.
Lots of explosions and
lots
shootings.
Lots of explosions and shootings and...
We're joined now by Kim Morgan, the other presenter of Midnight Sex Talk.
Good evening.
Hello.
Hello. Well, I came into this, and at first I was really worried that I might have missed some intricacies of the plot. And I was worried that I was going to sit here asking, who's he, who's she, and am I missing something vital here? But I think having come in at the end, the overall impression is that it's visually fantastically stimulating and very interesting. And you can see that there are individual frames and seconds of really astonishing visual art.
He's far more articulate than neither of us, isn't he?
Yeah, actually. We've sat the course.
I haven't been subjected to the entire experience.
We've been battered into submission.
What I was thinking was, I was watching it, I thought, well, it's the kind of thing that you expect to see in a room in an exhibition.
Mm. Yeah.
And if you went to a gallery and you could wander in and watch this for a few minutes and then wander out, I think you enjoy it a lot more. And I feel that it's almost unfair to the whole thing
to be sat and watching you're absolutely
in this context.
Right.
And I'm really grateful that I haven't sat through the whole thing, because I quite enjoyed watching it for a couple of minutes.
No, it was enjoyable. I really liked the first one.
It would have sent me seven shades of bonkers if I'd had to sit through any more of it than that. It was a bit weird, because watching it, you could see that, obviously, you know, when you watch, it's like when you're listening to a piece of music and you can hear that the underlying quality of songwriting is fantastic, but it's completely let down by no production, no orchestration, no arrangement. And sometimes you can hear that, and you're battling to try and find the true inspiration, the art in something. And it felt like that, because I could see, I mean, even someone as artistically illiterate as me can certainly, no, I am, I've got the artistic ability of a hedgehog. I really know nothing. I don't even know what I like or don't like. But I can certainly look at something and say, well, I can appreciate there's some fantastic artistic ability has gone into some of the creations in that. And watching it burn, you think, well, I've seen this developed by other artists, by other visual artists, by other video artists, and they've done amazing stuff with far less sort of material.
Mm.
And it's almost as if that guy, you know, there's obviously,
he doesn't have much restraint, bless him.
No, he doesn't have much restraint. But it's almost as if you took a great artist or some great pieces of art done by a quality artist and then let a couple of GCSE students who'd done too much dope and speed loose on making a film. Mm. And it just felt like, what were you thinking?
After 30 years of making the same film over and over again.
But I just wonder, thinking, because, I mean, you're looking at it, when I look at it, I think, no, there's some art in there. I'd like to spend time looking at
it. Yeah, I'd like to. Some of the earlier films would have been great slowed down rather than this just madly jumping.
I just wonder what his art's like. You know, what the canvases are like.
Are there any canvases?
If he didn't burn them all on camera or rip them up and eat them.
Well, does he make canvases as well?
I don't know. Well, you see him painting in the last couple. Again, that's three in a row. We can't let epileptics watch.
I'd say all of them, actually.
I don't know. I mean, you know, obviously he did paint.
Looked to me like he painted very well. If I went to a gallery, I'd really appreciate the chance to look at them and be interested in them. Or have them in a different context. I think that, obviously, great talent, great ability, but not as a filmmaker. Mm. Really not as a filmmaker. And possibly
Installationist.
If you had someone who was a very good curator, they could probably do something very interesting with that lot. But you would need someone who was really, really adept at curating and making and presenting it in the correct way, because then you get the chance to pick up on all the aspects that are great in it, but you wouldn't be subjected to the completely assaulting and,
well, particularly that one, which
bonkers,
was about the first Iraq War. It was obviously intended to be polemic and incendiary, but some of his other films seem to be as well, and they didn't necessarily have a point. It's just that it's, you know, like we said earlier, that the visual cacophony means that whatever themes he is trying to present to the audience sometimes get lost.
Get a bit lost. I mean, maybe the gesture he was making with the dragging the burning art, was, you thought for a moment that was from a war footage and someone was dragging a burning body.
Mm.
So maybe he's just saying, this is my oeuvre, and I've just gone back to the beginning of the bombs when I was in the war and fuck out and war, man.
Screenings of Jeff Keane's work are on at the BFI South Bank on the 17th, 19th, 25th and 27th of February 2009, and then touring the UK throughout March and beyond. You can find more info at www.bfi.org.uk. Next, you'll hear my interview with Wajid Yassin, the artistic director of Ear Cinema, about their touring project Late Noon Sun, which uses silent movie tropes and iconography in a haunting theatrical installation about murder and magic that combines projection and performance in an immersive 360-degree experience. Wajid seems to be entertaining Peter Greenaway's idea of a cinema that explodes the traditional format of the form contained within the proscenium arch. And before I started recording, I spoke to him about whether this was the case, and our interview starts off regarding whether he'd heard of this idea.
Really?
Yeah.
Has he? I know very little about this stuff. I mean, because I come from a sound art background.
Right, so right.
I'm curious about stumbling into areas that I've no idea about, you know.
No, I mean, Greenaway reckons that, you know, cinema is dead because we have all these new technologies. Mm. And therefore, if we do things with the medium, like project on four walls and have interactivity like you've got in this installation, then it'll bring whole new audiences, you know, that sort of add a level of interactivity.
Yeah.
That new technology, you know, the fact that you can, you know, edit films on computer and download stuff off the internet, whatever, it adds this level of interactivity that is required of cinema these days in order to survive, you know, in the modern world.
I don't buy it. I don't buy it. Actually, no. I think that, I mean, that there's no way that this level of interactivity, interactive film, cinema, installation art, whatever, is ever going to replace cinema. Mm. I don't think. I honestly think that it's a deviant, a branch of that.
Mm.
I don't think cinema, traditional cinema, needs this to survive. Hell no. I'm trying to say that to any Hollywood exec, you know, right? I don't buy it.
Well, what was the genesis of this project? I mean, I see that it's your the second thing that you've done as a theatre group.
Yeah. Well, it actually started off me walking into an ambisonic cube.
Okay.
And hearing a Spitfire, which seems to be a traditionally used by a lot of ambisonic sort of artists. I mean, it's got a fantastic sound. You mean, they're a whole Rolls Royce engine sort of feel to it. And hearing one sort of fly off my right shoulder about a mile away and swoop over, you know, ahead in a room a couple of meters sort of square just shook me to the core, frankly. I mean, I was astounded, you know. So that was the first point of contact, actually figuring out how that works. Well, actually not figuring out how it works, just knowing that it exists and getting people who know how it works to sort of basically incorporate in what I wanted to do. Mm. And of course, I've been working with performance companies for quite a while, sort of doing music for them and actually doing solo performances, which is a bit slightly uncomfortable. But and so it was just some way of marrying all these things together, because specifically within Air Cinema, we have the film element, we have the live art performance element, and of course the sound art element, so it's trying to bind these together in some interesting way. So Genesis was all from sound.
Well, I mean, I think sound is a really underused medium in terms of being an evocative sort of way of creating an atmosphere for an audience, whether it's in the theatre and you've only got a simple stage but can create, you know, a greater world through sound effects, or since in the regular cinema they've had all this surround sound technology for 20 years and so rarely utilize it properly, I think, you know, it's certainly something that should be explored more.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about surround sound, I think the difference between surround sound and ambisonics is that we have control of a vertical axis.
Okay.
Right? I mean, that's what kind of differentiates it. And so we can recreate actually everything we're hearing right now.
Mm.
At the slight home in this room, the guy's speaking downstairs and yakking about makeup, whatever, you know. I mean, we can actually recreate this entirely within ambisonic, so and you can't do that with surround, you know.
Okay.
And
in terms of the cinema elements, the first project you did, was that equally a mixture of projection and live performance?
It was absolutely. I mean, the heart of it is the idea of actually having these three art forms in themselves.
Okay.
And so the architecture is in place. We have four screens and we have minimum of eight speakers, which ambisonics requires. Well, six actually, but I mean we use eight to make it a firm cube. And live performance, and so that is the core architecture of the idea, and what I've been doing is basically inviting different filmmakers and different content people to come up with collaborative ideas, and so in this case I stumbled on the work of a filmmaker called Lizzie Oxby, which won a whole shitload of awards and fantastic stuff. I mean, obviously you can see by the quality of the film that she's made, but and she's been absolutely instrumental in actually putting this piece together. So that's the idea, actually. Okay. My hope, I think this is going to run for quite a while because there's quite a few galleries that are interested. Mm. We're off to the Arnolfinian and we're off to a sort of European tour next year. But my hope is for next year to ask Mr. Spankmeyer himself to try and come up with something. I think that'd be fantastic.
So it's almost like you've invented a new technology, and so you're inviting people to come and use it.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, in terms of animation, I was certainly seeing the influence of, say, The Brothers Key, you know, and I thought it was interesting that the filmmaker had lowered the frame rate to give it this sort of silent movie quality, which in a way kind of increases the shock when the actors walk out from behind the screen, that they sort of, they go from monochromatic, you know, unreality to solidity in colour. I mean, presumably that was an effect that you like.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think actually what happens is that part of the thing that I'm trying to get into, I mean, there's a whole lot of different ideas that I'm trying to bind into this thing. I mean, I really like the idea of ubiquitous computing, which is that it's that the technology that you use is hidden. I mean, an iPod's obviously the most obvious example of that. And it just does what you want it to do in a very clever way, you know, a very simple way. And same thing with this. I mean, there's an inordinate amount of technology that's involved in this thing. But as far as people can see, four screens and some space. But actually what happens is that I think an overt use of technology or an overt sort of focus on it, what it does is that, certainly for me, what it does is that it just causes a... There always seems to be some kind of film, like a sheath between me and whatever I'm expected to interact with.
Mm.
And as soon as you actually introduce bodies in space, there's another sensation that just zips through the space. We can't get away from evolution. We just can't, right? So seeing another body moving in form, which is just it's an immediate gluing effect somehow. Mm. So it's really important. But of course, it can't be done. Arbitrarily or randomly, you know, and it has to be totally tied in with what's happening. Either they're exploring emotion in space, or they're actually exploring, in this case, a narrative. This is really trying to stick to a narrative and try and explain that. It's a broken narrative, there's no doubt about it. It's a fairly abstracted narrative, but there is one that underlies it all. And we've tried to sort of make that slightly clearer by using a voiceover. I think I'm going to change it. I've got the architect of this piece as it stands, the Leighton and Son piece, and there's a lot of things I'm going to change.
Okay.
Just simply because I can.
Well, I suppose that is something, if you've got a live element and the fact that it's running on computer rather than you press start at the beginning on a DVD and stop at the end,
means
that you can continue to manipulate it like you would any sort of theatrical experience throughout
its
run.
Absolutely.
And is that something that appeals in a way? Because there seems to be a lot of interest in silent movie, for example, at the moment, having a performative nature that if you see it with a new score, even that will be different every time you see it, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is, I think it's rock and roll, frankly.
Mm.
I think this is the thing I used to be, I still am actually, but I mean, lots of rock and roll bands. And this feeling of letting go of I don't know, expected form, somehow. The risk.
Mm.
You know, glorious fucking risk. And so keeping it open-ended like this is, for me, you know, just personally very satisfying, very thrilling. So it'll be interesting to see how it mutates, because it will, you know.
I mean, in terms of the visuals, it does have a kind of silent movie quality to it. And it brought to mind an interview I did last year with Matthew Sweet, who's this British documentarian. And he was saying that seeing silent movies reminds him of going to a seance, because apart from the fact you're aware that everyone in the movie has died, you know, because it's that long ago, the technology, because it's a little bit fragmentary and keeps on, you know, sort of stuttering, whatever, makes you feel more like you're communicating with the dead rather than you know communicating with the living.
Sure. Did you feel that in this piece?
No, definitely.
Yeah. Excellent.
I mean, it seems apt that it's premiering just before Halloween. I mean, was the timing something that's important to you?
Not particularly. No. I mean, I think it's something that Emma Quinn, who's the live media director here at the RCA. It's something that she probably had in mind. Maybe because, you know, she probably gets my style and thought it'd be appropriate to you know, stick it in place around Halloween. But I might even just spook it up a little bit more for Halloween.
Okay.
Have the flying creatures actually erupt from that? are you interested in films like, for example, The Purple Rose of Cairo, where you have a character leaving a cinema screen and entering the real world?
In fact, I mean, this sometimes. I suppose, I mean, I'm not going to latch onto that because I'm not a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Right, remember that. I mean, I'm kind of just overlooking this thing and allowing... The point about this is actually making the right choice of people.
Mm.
And I'm just knowing the architecture of the piece and actually figuring out whether they can fit into this thing and do it well.
Mm.
And so Lizzie might be able to sort of tell you whether she finds that's a particular quirk in her own filmmaking. Mm. I don't think so, actually, when she makes her own films. But obviously this piece can allow that.
Mm.
So I think this is the first time this has happened. Because, of course, even you know, in the film that you talk about, there's still an actor that comes out, which is still a film, right?
Yeah.
We're really doing it.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, I think one thing that's interesting, it seems to be a leitmotif in the piece, is the idea of mirroring. Mm. Either in terms of the image on one screen has an analogue on the opposite, like light from a spotlight shining onto the other side, or the actions of the actresses in the theatrical stage mirroring each other as well. I mean, because you have this cubic environment, is that something that kind of suggests itself as well in order to kind of stop the audience getting too sort of distracted by everything going on around them? At times you need to have mirroring and analogues just center it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very tricky thing to get right, actually, because it can become really overwhelming. I mean, there's so many sort of components to this thing, and of course we don't have eyes on all, we don't have eight eyes really, right, do we? So but that's one of the crucial elements about the whole idea about this thing, is that actually we don't overwhelm people.
Mm.
And so you get it's a strange thing to sort of to see music choreographically.
Mm.
Well, it's not a strange thing, but I mean, we do that anyway. Obviously there's movement within music in itself, but there has to be a cohesive movement between all three different forms, and they have to dance between themselves, so that actually that there isn't a sort of competitive streak to any one of them. Otherwise, the whole cohesive experience is shattered, you know, it'll go. So it is really tricky to keep that in check. And what that demands is constant dialogue, just between the people who are actually making everything, you know. So, I scored the music for this, and I've never scored for cello or violin before, and I really bloody enjoyed it, actually. Because I come from a kind of experimental electronics sort of background, really. And bringing in cellists and bringing in sort of violinists and saying, no, do this. Play. No, this is exactly what I want you to play. And making them come alive. It's fantastic, really. I really enjoyed it. I found a new talent. I mean, the whole point about actually making sure that it's not overwhelming, it is a consideration and quite tricky to actually get right.
And if audiences come to visit the space during the day, how does it work as an installation?
Well, actually, we're going to strip away the performers are not in space. Mm. At the moment, the music I'm stripping away.
Okay.
And I'm going to add in some slightly more sound effects. And actually, what it'll do is that it'll allow the ambisonics to sort of run slightly more cleaner.
Okay.
Simply because actually, when there is 30, 40 bodies in space, it does interfere with a little bit of that in itself. So so it's probably going to be slightly more crafted in terms of just sound effects and four screens using, playing the films.
Okay. So during the afternoon, it just sort of runs on a loop and people wander in and out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Late Noon Sun is next on at the Colchester Arts Centre on the 18th of February 2009. And for future performances, please visit www.earcinema.co.uk for more info. In March, Electric Sheep magazine has two screenings to help promote the release of the new print issue. At 7:30 p.m. on the 9th of March, we're showing Guillermo del Toro's debut film Kronos at the Roxy Bar and Screen in Borough High Street. and on the 15th, as part of a double bill, were showing the absurdist Japanese superhero film Starman, Evil Brain from Outer Space, at Vibe Live above the Vibe Bar on Brick Lane at 2 p.m. For more info about these free screenings and other Electric Sheep events, please visit www.electricsheepmagazine.com, and there'll be a new episode of the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast online next month. Thanks for listening.